being out podcasts sometimes start or end with like some little bit of like additional dialogue that was funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we weren't funny though.
I know, but we will be sometimes. You have read that Muad'Dib had no playmates his own age on Caladan. The dangers were too great. But Muad'Dib did have wonderful companion teachers. There was Gurney Halleck, the troubadour warrior. You'll sing some of Gurney's songs as you read along in this book. There was Thufir Hawat, the old Mented master of assassins, who struck fear into the hearts of even the Padishah Emperor. There were Duncan Idaho, the sword master of the Ginaz, Dr. Wellington Yui, a name black in treachery, the bright in knowledge, the Lady Jessica, who guided her son in the Bene Gesserit way, and of course, the Duke Leto, whose qualities as a father have long been overlooked.
From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
I'm Stephen Guidry, an art director for film and television.
And I'm Marlon Olivier, a music librarian and archivist.
And we love Dune.
We really love Dune.
So much so that we started this podcast, another chapter-by-chapter analysis of the novel Dune by Frank Herbert from 1965.
And all the additional movies, video games, media that we can think of.
And more!
So we're not going to explain every time or character unless we feel the need for context. So this is sort of a book club.
Sort of a book club, right. So in other words, you should read the book. Otherwise,
We've got spoiler signs, the likes of which even God has never seen.
All right. Today's the day for me inserting an extra word here and there. I just did it there, and I did it earlier in the quote from A Child's History of Muad'Dib.
Yeah, so. you're just slightly improving upon one of the greatest science fiction novels of all time.
I know.
Everything could use a little tweaking here and there.
A little tweaking. I love that Princess Irulan is so presumptuous in that we want to sing some of Gurney's songs as we read along in the book. That's a real strong engagement with her book.
Yeah, well, let's just say that the songs that we get that that Gurney gives us don't exactly seem like the sort of thing children really want to sing.
Yeah, I don't know. They're pretty darky.
And they don't rhyme. He calls them tone poems at some point, which is really, you know, kids love their tone poetry.
Yeah, there's some Nick Cave songs.
Yeah.
So this set chapter starts off with Thufir Hawat. He's mentioned in the intro that, you know, Paul's group of adult friends, his teachers. So Thufir comes in. He gives Paul a little bit of a hard time because Paul's not doing best practices in terms of, what would you call it? Like political intrigue, safety, assassination, sitting. Yeah.
He's sitting wrong.
He's sitting wrong with his back to the door. Someone can sneak up on him. He should be sitting facing the door or in a corner or some other configuration. And they chat about the upcoming trip to Arrakis. And you get a sense of Hawat's relationship with Paul and his relationship with Jessica a little bit. And I think in this section, Paul is like, he's really being a really good boy. He's doing lots of good boy stuff. He's like studying at the table with all of his maps and charts, learning about Dune.
Paul's a very good boy. Every question he asks is very on topic. He's asking Thufir about, you know, what are we going to see on this planet that we're heading to and everything? And there's a lot of stress in this chapter about how dangerous Dune is.
Yeah, so tell me, how do you think the fencing mirror works?
I don't know. It's a really good, I mean, it
first it's very you, evocative.
Right, you know? Well, right, because first you hear fencing mirror, and you think of in movies where boxers do mirror box, you know, they box themselves in a mirror, sure. Sort of. So you think, okay, it's a fencing mirror, but then it has crystal prisms that are quiescent, and suddenly my brain thinks of the dark crystal and thinks of sort of prisms, and then it becomes this. I don't know. I guess you could say that it's some sort of mirror meant to show you yourself from all angles. From multiple angles. I'm liking this thing that I'm making up in my brain right now. So that's what I think it is. That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it. So it's prisms. It's like a hall of mirrors. you sort of look into it and you see yourself multiplied or reflected, you know, in sort of multiple slightly different angles, kind of like those mirrors they have in a wedding dress room.
You know? Right. Yeah. They have those in other places. Yeah.
Right.
I used to like those mirrors as a kid.
You can get a good angle in the right way and you can get the infinity effect going in them.
Yeah, my grandparents on my mother's side, they had a bathroom that had a mirror on opposite walls, like an entire like wall length mirror. So it was an amazing like infinite mirror chamber. But anyway, I think that's a great theory on the fencing mirror, because it obviously does more than a regular mirror, because it's got these prisms that are off right now. And when you turn the prisms on, you would expect it to bend light in all sorts of crazy ways, and that makes sense.
I love that you called this a chapter about Paul's adult friends. It's because there's all these hyphenated words in the first in the intro, and I think of adult friends being this hyphenated word.
I love like inappropriate use of the word friend. Like my friends Mary and Ben, when their daughter was really young, Grace, when she was like 2 or 1.5, they'd be like, "Oh, look, it's your friend Marlon," and I'd be like, "Yeah, me and Grace, we're like best friends. Like we have all this stuff in common. We do all this stuff together. You know, we have a really tight bond." And she's like, "Shut up." Anyway, so yeah, his adult friends, you know, there's a lot of anxiety related to Dune in this chapter. I think it's really funny because Thufir walks in, Paul's got all of his like homework spread out on his desk, being a good boy, studying. He says he's been studying the storms on Arrakis. And Thufir's like, "The storms, I see." And then Paul's like, "They sound pretty bad."
Yeah, pretty bad.
Which is, yeah, I think Thufir would agree with that.
Thufir here is set up in kind of a funny way, right? He has this moment of immediately, I think not the first time, I don't think. Is this the first time somebody calls Jessica a witch? Because Thufir does. Thufir's like, that witch mother of his has been training him whenever Paul hears him coming down the hall.
Yeah, he thinks this.
Yeah, so yeah. He thinks about the witch mother. So, and then he's also, immediately when he mentions the Fremen, after Paul says the thing about the bad storm, he's like, "Oh, the Fremen wear these big robes and they stink."
They stink. Yeah, they stink.
So it's goodness. Like a little racism and a little bit of misogyny right out the gate. Very nice.
He's being a little judgmental.
Yeah, he's definitely the boomer in this story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Gurney's a boomer too, but Gurney's more like a corny boomer.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. You're right.
And so they
Paul
get into
and
a
his
few
boomer
things.
Friends.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, they're talking about the storms, and Paul asks the kind of obvious question. He says, "Why don't they have weather control?" And Thufir says, "Arrakis has special problems. Costs are higher. There'd be maintenance." He says, "Your father's house isn't one of the big rich ones, lad. You know that." I kind of wish this point was never raised, this idea of weather control, because I think it's a question that if anyone was to actually pursue it, would kind of uncover some of the Fremen relationship to the guild and the intentional hiding of things on Arrakis. I think it's a thing that's really glossed over in a weird way, because certainly the Harkonnens would have enough money to do weather control. And if there was a place that was ever worth investing a huge amount of money to do that, it would be Arrakis because of the profits that I think it would return.
Yeah, I always struggle to find a sort of parallel to the Atreides in the modern world. It's like Belgium, you know. It's like, I mean, what's a country that does okay, but and everybody kind of likes, but isn't super wealthy? And so it's possible that they really don't know that there's this. I mean, the weather control stuff is all part of the guild emperor. Conspiracy, right?
Well, it's part of the whole guild Fremen conspiracy, right? Like weather control would, I think, imply satellites.
Yep.
And also weather control would mean people could enter the deep desert, essentially, right? Yeah. So as long as they can't enter the deep desert, the Fremen can do their terraforming and stuff. Right. So I'm just surprised. I mean, whatever, you know, the House Atreides finances are, whatever knowledge they have of this stuff, I'm just surprised it's not a bigger conversation. How's the Lansdrad and the Emperor and the Guild all not just like, well, the Guild, you know, outside of their conspiracy with the Fremen, how's everyone not like, Yeah, we should get some weather control on Arrakis. It would be in everyone's best interest, especially the Harkonnens, who are rich.
I guess the guild could just say it's 1 billion whatever they use. I don't know. I forget what the money term is. You know, I mean, the guild could just make it always prohibitively expensive.
Right. I just wish if anybody would know that, that would be Thufir.
Sure.
And I wish Thufir would just be the guilds always charge too high a price for anyone to pay for that. It's a little weird.
Yeah.
But we assume it has to do with logistical challenges.
You know?
The fact that he says your father's house isn't one of the big rich ones suggests that a big rich one could pay for that, and I don't like that.
I do think there is a little sub story in Dune about Thufir losing his edge, to quote LCD Sound System.
He's definitely lost his edge in this case.
You mentioned earlier that the next little segment is basically a flashback to Paul talking with the Reverend Mother. And so the Reverend Mother actually gives him a little more dirt, or should I say sand, on the move to Arrakis. She gets again into the political threats that Paul's going to be seeing. And of course, we know she has this whole ignore the Duke because he's about to be out of the picture anyway, and so she's clearly concerned to get Paul sort of caught up on the nasty business of being a leader in this treacherous world.
I kind of have some problems with this flashback section. I feel like the Reverend Mother speaks in really broad, almost hokey terms that are kind of atonal with kind of her usual conversation.
So at some point, Paul says he is caught by her tone. So she says this little segment where it sort of starts with this mention of water starvation. And I was curious because I didn't remember her mentioning this, but then
it becomes a flashback.
And she says, shelter will mean a hollow out of the wind and hidden from view. You'll ride upon your own 2 feet without thopter or ground car or mount. And Paul had been caught more by her tone, sing-song and wavering, than by her words. I'm wondering if this part is meant to be almost this sort of foresight moment for her, and that's why she's sort of chanting it.
Right, and I love this first part.
Yeah, me too.
This first part, I think, is fantastic. It's where the conversation proceeds that I don't like.
Right, I was going to say, and then it becomes very, like you said, this weird, overly simplistic moment right after this kind of cool, lyrical witch talk.
Yeah, it's really strange. It's funny because I have my, and you know, we'll address these later, but my Kol Wahad and Gam Jabbar are literally back-to-back because it's something I love transitioning to something I don't love. And this chapter does this quite a bit. This chapter has, like, a greater frequency of kind of, like, waxing poetic and lyrical, like, moments. And it's got a lot of really great, like, turns of phrase. But it also has some of this really content-wise, like, broad stuff where you're like, duh. You know, why does that need to be explained to Paul in these really broad terms?
Yeah, this whole section is a lot of, I don't want to necessarily say trite, but they're definitely sort of these aphorisms. A leader is someone who does this. What is it? It's like, a leader is one who does this. A leader does this.
Right. You attract more, whatever, bees with honey, you know? It's all this very broad stuff. Like, lead with, like, charm rather than coercion and stuff. And you're like, well, yeah, you know?
Right.
And she, like, bolsters that kind of idea by saying, none of your ancestors, like, have learned how to lead. And are you seriously telling me that the Duke, who's, like, one of the favorites in the Lansdrad, has not, like, led with, you know, charm and appeal rather than coercion? I mean, it seems pretty obvious that he has.
I don't know exactly what she's getting at, unless there's a possible reading that she's kind of just being, this is all still, she's sort of testing by pushing him and saying, yeah, your father's going to lose this planet, he's going to lose the next planet, and the one after that.
Yeah, she's just shit-talking Leto like crazy. And she sounds like she's talking about shit she doesn't understand, kind of, for the first time in the book. And it's weird, you know, she says the stuff about Dune. It doesn't even sound that bad, the thing she says about it. And then later on, Paul's talking to, I think, Gurney, and he's like, is Dune really as bad as she makes it sound? And he's like, it could never be that bad. And I went back and read it, and I was like, she didn't make it sound that bad. I mean, she makes it sound bad in that Duke Leto's gonna, like, probably get killed, and that it's a trap, but, like, you know.
I think what she implies, that he's going to be outside of the ducal house, sort of, and the protections of the house, I mean, why would the Duke's son need to blacken his eye pits and learn about walking on his own 2 feet and all that stuff? That, if, you know, if everything proceeded as normal, he wouldn't be out in the desert. So I think there's some of that, and maybe that's what the reaction is, where he's like, no, you'll never have to really learn about, you won't have to learn about the desert, just like, you know.
Sure. I just assume he'd want to, like, learn some of the ways of the desert if his family's going to move there. But yeah, there's lots of, like even, you know, at during this segment where she's, like, dissing on Leto and his ancestors, and when she's talking about these really broad things like learning of the wise, justice of the great, this really boring stuff, there's little bits of language in there, though, that really shine, because she starts off by saying, grave this on your memory, you know? And there are lots of moments in this chapter like that. Like, Thufir talks about considering Arrakis, the planet, as an enemy and stuff like that. Like, there are lots of little bits of writing that I really appreciate in this chapter. They talk about persuading rather than compelling, and to persuade allies, a good leader must lay the best coffee hearth to attract the finest men. You know, there's lots of, like, just bright spots.
Yeah, I have the coffee hearth underlined because I think it's one of those moments where this thing that will come up way later in the book is already here, because we're going to get coffee later in the book. I mean, a coffee hearth is not, that's not a phrase that I think about. I'm sure the first time I read it, my brain just blew past it, you know? I mean, I know what those two words are kind of independently, but they're being so significant is interesting here. I do really like that Paul says that she's told him he had some unlearning to do, and Hawat's like, yeah, you definitely. I like that too. I like the idea that Paul's a little too big for his britches sometimes. Because there's a pretty good characterization of Paul here, always kind of being like, oh, I would have known it was you coming down the hall. And he's like, those sounds could have been faked. And he's like, I would have known if they were faked, you know? There's like, Paul's doing a lot of, I know better than my elders.
Yeah, he's a good boy, but he's confident, a little overconfident.
Yeah, I mean, and it's depressing because he doesn't have friends. So he doesn't have a friend to say, you're a real jerk, Paul. He has only these people that have to treat him as either their child or as the Duke's son, you know? I really like that part of this chapter too, how many times you're reminded, I mean, from the intro on, that these are his only friends in the world, these kind of weirdo adults.
Yeah, and I do like the kind of banter that's established between Paul and Thufir and Gurney. But, you know, there's another moment where Paul is recounting his conversations with the Reverend Mother before we move on to Gurney's arrival, where he says that a good leader must learn his world's language. It's very different for every world. And she said she means the language of the rocks and growing things, the language you don't just hear with your ears. And Paul responds, that's what Dr. Yui calls the mystery of life. And I'm just like, what is going on here? Like, the mystery of life is just like going outside and meditating and, like, learning about, like, the environment, and if you're going to rule a planet, kind of understand the way it works. Like, yeah, no shit. Like, I mean, whether it's self, like, you know, actualization or, like, understanding the complexity of the place you're ruling, like, I mean, it just all seems like common sense.
Yeah, but I like it. I like, because it sounds like some shit that would be in a Disney video, like a film strip that you would see in the night, like from the 1950s, like going to Disneyland, and you would go see whatever, the magic of petroleum, and they would go, it's part of the mystery of life, the cycle that brings all things together, and now we have oil into our automobiles. I mean, I think that's what it reminds me of, and I like this moment of Paul as a kid just remembering this sort of key phrase that Dr. Yui probably said in some mini lecture about the mystery of life. It is trite, but it's that same kind of Paul's adult friends and like Paul's teachers, you know, that's kind of the only reference point he has. So I like it. I mean, I think it's meant to be cheesy, and I like that immediately Reverend Mother's kind of like, that's bullshit. That's not what I'm talking about at all.
Right. I guess I just think of Paul as being more like sophisticated than to like buy into this mystery of life, like just hokum kind of vague term.
I think they're trying to set up a bit of a contrast with that sort of Disney-fied, here's the story of life. It's, you know, whether it's like, it's the water cycle. The rain goes up, the rain comes down, the water goes up, and that's what we call the water cycle.
But I know, but Paul's 15. He's not like 10 or something, you know? And
I think you overestimate like, a 15-year-old in 1965.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. I mean, a 15-year-old now has the internet.
Right, but, right. I mean, a 15-year-old now, I mean, it wouldn't have gotten to this point in the conversation anyway, so... at least from what I understand.
I know, but Paul's about to, like, match, like knife-fighting skills with Gurney Halleck, and I feel like someone that can do that, like, has to understand the basics of, like, know your environment, know the, like, factors that, you know, understand the complexity of what surrounds you, you know, because that applies to combat, that applies to everything, it applies to governing, and it applies to, like, you know, your mental and physical well-being, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is a moment of Paul being childish. I think Paul's childish a lot in this chapter. I think the desire to impress your elders by quoting something that another elder said to you resonates with me, thinking about myself as a obnoxious, overly precocious teenager.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, watching a documentary and being like, I've heard of that. That's called... like that's called
now that you're illustrating it with your own like precocious high school persona, now I get it. It makes sense now.
Yeah,
I just had to like overlay that image onto Paul.
Yeah, imagine me when you knew me in high school being like, oh yeah, I saw that in a documentary, that's called whatever, hydrolysis. But I like that the Reverend Mother is like, no, it's not the mystery of life. You can't learn a process by stopping it. I like that. I mean, that implies the sort of way that Yui and these science people in Paul's life kind of apply knowledge by breaking things down, you know?
Sure.
And she doesn't like that. But it's weird because just before that, she's like, everything is four things. 1, 2, 3, 4. And before that, she's like, there's a tripod. 1, 2, 3. So she does the same thing.
Yeah, so after this flashback, Thufir leaves, having interrogated Paul about the Reverend Mother and her kind of like really broad statements about like life, and he leaves. Gurney Halleck comes in. He's got a bunch of weapons. He's ugly. They make a point of emphasizing that. They mention Duncan Idaho. He's always getting short shrift. Poor Duncan. He's not even around yet, and he's only going to appear briefly later.
I love that the intro is like Duncan, the Swordmaster of Gazaz, whatever that is.
Yeah, goodness.
Which we'll explain that of Gazaz, and then he's not appearing in this chapter.
Right. So he's not in this chapter. They really emphasize that Gurney is worn, kind of ragged, ugly. He's kind of a little more direct and rough than Thufir is. Thufir kind of like gradually walks in, addresses Paul from behind about, you know, sitting in this particular orientation, very sort of like Master of Assassins kind of like entry, like I could have snuck up on you and killed you just now, hee hee. Whereas Gurney just sort of like, he kind of like slams the door open and like kicks it closed with his foot and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's just got all these weapons that he like drops out on the table and it's great.
Right, you imagine him like clinking and clanking as he's coming in really noisily and sort of dropping things. Just a little bit, he's much more casual.
Yeah, and he's got like rapiers, bodkins, kinjals. He's got all these like knives and things. So I just love the emphasis is just on let's learn all of this like hand-to-hand combat. And I guess that's just, you know, the result of S.H.I.E.L.D. technology.
Yeah, I like that he brings in a... There's a surprising bit of who knows what's going to happen right now. It's not like he comes in with one thing and says, today is Tuesday, that's rapier practice. He kind of just throws a bunch of shit on the table and then, you know, they kind of grab a thing, he grabs a thing, and then they go at it. Yeah, the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff obviously is what we're supposed to be taking away from this little fight that they have here.
Yeah, and so they, you know, they joke around. There's some good dad jokes and stuff. At one point, Gurney kind of sings an excerpt from a song that mentions Galatian girls will do it for pearls and the Arakeen for water. It's just sort of this like kind of body thing, and Paul specifically says, if my mother heard you singing like that in the castle, she'd have your ear on the wall for decorations. It's just this like kind of like genteel decorum like junk that Paul's doing, where you're just like, oh my god, you're such a good boy. Like, does anybody care that Gertie's singing this song?
Alright, so I've gotta talk about this next part. What do you think when you hear the following? This is Gurney speaking back to Paul. Poor decoration too, they having been bruised so much, listening at keyholes, while a young lad I know practiced some strange ditties on his baliset. What is going
okay, well,
on?
Okay, so look, I read it. I went with the surface reading that sometimes Paul likes to try to like pick out a tune on the baliset, and Gurney, like hearing it, you know, from the hallway, peeks in and is like, "Oh, good for Paul. He's not very good at playing. It hurts my ears, but I'm glad he's doing it." Whereas I think you've got a little more provocative read on that.
I mean,
because first of all, it'd be fucking weird for Gurney to be peeking in a keyhole if Paul's doing anything.
No,
else.
He just listens. He just listens. He doesn't peek. He just listens.
He listens to Paul make breathy grunting sounds.
This is the only mention we get of Paul owning a baliset, as far as I know.
Sure.
I'm just saying, a 15-year-old in the castle who has no friends, and immediately after this reference to this bawdy song about consuming flames and the Caladanian
sure.
daughter, and they're obviously doing a little banter back and forth that I think Gurney's better at, because then Paul immediately says, so you've forgotten what it's like to find sand in your bed. I mean, it's fine. If Paul is like sitting there plucking through the long and winding road, or some stairway to heaven, that is totally also a thing a 15-year-old would do, but it's hard for me not to think this is maybe saying both. Let's just say that.
I know. It's just the idea. I feel like if I was to do this, I would construct it in a different way. If I was to be like, oh, whatever, who cares about my like my risque song when I know you're a 15-year-old who's horny and masturbates, you know? Would you go about saying like, oh, my ears are bruised from the sounds of your like exertions through the keyhole? Or I mean, it's so weird that Gurney would frame it in that, like, I heard you masturbating and the sound like hurt my ears. It was so grotesque, you know? That's weird. It's a little weird to like twist it up quite that much.
Sure, yeah.
But I don't know. It's also cool. It's also cool that he would suggest it hurt his ears.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, we can let it rest. I don't really want to talk too much about 15-year-old Paul, what he's getting up to in his room by himself, but you know, teens will be teens.
So the
next section is the big fight in this scene, and like you said, this is all sword fighting. I think this is the only actual sword fight we see, and it's never been clear to me, but I don't think it's the case that swords are necessarily common as battle weapons. I think this is sort of somewhere between like the way that a rich kid would have fencing lessons, right? And training you for an actual need to defend yourself. It feels like it's the sort of thing where probably everybody has a dagger, but I think they use, what do they say? They say they mention some kind of projectile weapon here, right?
He lays it out on the table, the slow pellet stunners, right? Yeah. Which is why I was like, why do they have so many, like, bladed weapons, you know? If you have guns that can penetrate shields and stuff. So, I don't know. I think it's because a lot of conflict takes place in the form of, like, backroom kind of, like, assassinations sure. and fights and stuff. That's not open combat.
You could imagine maybe a situation where you fire some kind of projectile to sort of get someone off balance, even if they've got a shield. Because presumably there would be some, not to get all, like, physics, but there would be a physical reaction. If you shoot someone in a shield, there's physics still work, right? So it's still sort of hit them. It wouldn't penetrate. And then you get in close and maybe, you know, slice them through the shield.
Sure.
I can imagine that pretty easily.
So yeah, I mean, there are definitely some highlights through here. Like, they start kind of with a mock fight with a blunted blade, which I think is probably how they normally train. And then the situation, like, quickly escalates. And Paul actually second guesses Gurney's motives for a moment, thinking he might actually, like, intend him harm because he's going at things so intently in response to Paul being like, oh, I'm not really in the mood for fighting.
Yeah, that's a very good line. We'll come back to that line. So yes, Paul thinks he's going to, maybe this is betrayal, and obviously we know there is a potential betrayal. We heard about that from the Harkonnens. I forget whether the Reverend Mother has mentioned betrayal to Paul yet, or at all. But I will say, going back to what I was saying before, that when they get to the end of the fight, Paul obeyed and looks down and sees Halleck's Kindle thrust under the table's edge, the tip almost touching Paul's groin.
He's going after the hog. He knows Paul has been, like, exerting himself.
I know.
Expending his energy in, like, untoward ways. And so he's gonna nip it in the
he
bud.
He doesn't want him to practice those strange ditties on his balisette. And then we have this denouement, and I actually really like this denouement. So they finish the fight, and basically Gurney says, you know, Paul asks him, would you really have hurt me? And he said, oh, well, I would have made you remember it. I'd given you a scar. Paul sort of says, my daddy would be mad at you if you did that. And he was like, well, your daddy would be mad at me if I didn't do that, really. And then there's a nice, we'll come back to this because I think this is going to be, there's, I think maybe my Colwahad moment is here. I really did like this ending where we get into Gurney's head a little bit while he's piloting the training dummy.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You don't see this in this book very often, right? You don't have, like, this kind of contrast between someone. Usually when people are thinking about things, it's whatever they are working on in that moment.
Right.
You know, like, I do like that this is kind of a reflection on his past and, like, what he's become in the service of the Atreides and kind of his, like, I don't know, almost emotional well-being in this moment while he's piloting the dummy.
Yeah, I will say, looking ahead, there's some, Gurney sort of annoys me at some points in this book, but this part, it actually makes me really like Gurney. I really liked that the beginning of this, Gurney starts thinking about Paul, and he says, how soon this child must assume his manhood, how soon he must read that form within his mind, that contract of brutal caution, to enter the necessary fact on the necessary line, quote, please list your next of kin. And I like that little political, the sort of moment of being sad that a kid has to become an adult, and in this kind of gross world they live in, where really your next of kin is the most important thing, because it's all mm-hmm. about being a duke and having a son, and then that duke, you know, your son becomes the duke, and then he has a son, and the son becomes a duke, and that he's sad that Paul's at 15, his innocence is going away.
Yeah, no, there's, like I said, this chapter's full of these wonderful little, like, lyrical turns and kind of romantic moments a bit. There's, like, it's full. This last section of Gurney's full of it, and I don't want to start quoting them left and right because I don't want to accidentally pull your Colwahad.
It's okay.
But
go ahead. I mean, if there's something lovely you really want to pull, I, you know.
I mean, look, I mean, I've kind of already gone over my Kol Wahad a little bit. So yeah, these are going to overlap sometimes, but he talks about having pain, like a blister. He says all that was left of some lost yesterday that time has pruned off of him. And then later he compares himself to a fruit tree that's been grafted with all of these parts that have become like what he is now and stuff. And it's just, I don't know. It's all really pretty beautiful. And even in the fight, like there's a moment, this isn't Gurney, but when Paul's like narrating the fight before it kind of escalates, he says, this is so great. He says, attack has the sole purpose of tricking the opponent into a misstep, setting him up for the attack sinister.
Yeah.
I just think the chapter's full of like great little moments. Like
I love the attack sinister. There's another reference to sinister. I had a little note because not to get too English 101, but it's really significant that another thing that happens in this chapter is Paul puts his right hand in the box. And there are a bunch of moments in this chapter where they talk about the right hand. And the left hand is, of course, the sinister hand. And I think sinister here is kind of has those two meanings, like anything you do left-handed.
Sure.
And also the Gam Jabbar is the high-handed enemy. So anyway, I think there's a lot of good... I'm sure someone who's like a Renaissance scholar would be like, yeah, duh, left hand, right hand, that's all duh. But I think it's cool, you know?
Yeah, this is the last bit I'll quote from the Gurney's kind of reflections, just because I just wanted to get your take on it. Toward the end of the chapter, he goes, this thought only added to Halleck's sadness. I'm infected by mood, he thought. And he began to wonder about Paul, if the boy ever listened fearfully to his pillow throbbing in the night.
Look, I mean, let's be... I think I know what's going on here in this chapter, at least in the second half. I underlined it. I don't know what that means, actually. I don't. I mean, maybe it's just... Is it just... I don't know. You know, I used to...
Is that like if you're really stressed out, you might like hear your heartbeat or pulse in your head or something?
I guess.
Like against the pillow?
I guess. I used to have a real... To get personal, when I was bullied as a kid, I remember lying in bed and thinking about the fact that my bullies were also lying in bed at the same time as me. and I don't know, having a little bit of a that kind of empathy for the bully moment, and that's not really what's going on here, but it reminds me of that moment where your mind sort of is racing and whatnot kind of before you actually go to sleep. I mean, fearful... If he's ever listened fearfully to his pillow throbbing in the night, I mean, it sounds like somewhere between insomnia and a really intense self-reflection.
Sure, and it's an example of what Herbert does, like, more frequently than you expect in this book. He'll have these
just incredibly kind of vague, kind of colorful moments where you're like, I'm not even really sure what that means, you know, how literally I'm supposed to take it. You get a lot of that, I think, when he gets more into like descriptions of the desert. But yeah, I think this is a good example of it.
Yeah. I'll read one more thing because I think we're starting to be a little bit like Gurney here. It says his mind seemed to be in two parts, one alert to the needs of the training fight, and the other wandering in fly buzz. Yeah. I love that. Like, I don't know what it means.
Yeah. Yep.
It's hyphenated. Fly buzz. Wandering in fly buzz is really good. So
yeah, it's wonderful because it could be something literally out of the world that we just don't know and are speculating on. Yeah. Or it could just be sort of like a phonetic thing or like a kinetic thing.
Yeah.
You know, just saying this sounds like this idea, you know, of being sort of like... A daydreamy or like flittering state, you know?
Yep. All right. So my last thing, and then we'll move on. It was not until I was rereading it this time that I realized that, I have a song that sort of quotes, Gurney Halleck here. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets. And then my song, yeah. I change it. Yeah, if wishes were fishes, we'd all be drowning in scales. And I'm sure that was because I just didn't know where the expression had come from. I guess it's a I don't know if it's a common expression. I only know it from here, and then I put it in a song. Maybe I'll play a little piece of the song in the episode.
Yeah, that'd be great. That's enough of us talking about Dune, but did you know anybody can be a Dune buddy?
That's right, Marlon. So we're going to chat with our friend Marianne, who's reading Dune for the first time.
You consider doing this Dune podcast active? Is that part of an active lifestyle?
No.
Is reading Dune part of an active lifestyle?
Mm-mm. No, reading Dune... It does take effort, but...
Well, what sort of lifestyle is reading Dune a part of?
It's part of a nerd lifestyle. Nerdy, like, bookwormy lifestyle.
That's but you said you were a bookworm, though.
I am, yeah. Well, hmm. That doesn't mean I'm active all the time.
But that means you live a Dune lifestyle, sort of.
It's okay to embrace.
Sometimes that. I do. Yeah, sometimes I do.
Hey, Marianne.
Hey, Steven. Hey, Marlon. Hey.
How's Dune going?
Dune's going. I just finished chapter 4.
What happens in chapter 4?
So chapter 4 is a Paul-centered chapter. They introduce us to... who I want to be my favorite character, the Master of Assassins, just simply because his title's Master of Assassins. I forget his name, Thurwat or something. Anyway, we meet him, and then we also meet a weapons master, some little chunky dude. That's all I can recall about him. I don't remember his name, but he's like this chunky guy who's Paul's favorite person. And there's this just... I don't know, the sense that things are really going to be tough. They're leaving for the Arrakis planet tomorrow. So everybody's on, the elders are tense, and it seems that it's very important that Paul is prepared for what he's going to face. It sounds like this new planet's going to be terrible. You know, they talk about storms that like obliterate everything in their way, and it turns everything to dust and bone, and then not just bone but fragments of bone, and just awful. They have to wear these little suits so that they don't waste any water, including sweat. I believe those are still suits, Marlon, is that right? And there is some weirdos, I don't know if they're called Fremen or Freemen or something. Anyway, those I don't know. I try not to focus on things I don't know. I just try to push through since we were a little bit behind. So I was like, just read it once and enjoy.
Do you think you would enjoy Dune? I know you said it was a terrible place, but you like hot places.
I like hot places, but I don't like to be thirsty all the time. And it sounds like that's something to be considered. The guy's even thinking about it now. He hasn't even left, and he's already thirsty. Like, his mouth is dry just thinking about Dune.
You've got some awesome insight in that. Number one, that the elders are feeling really tense before the move. I think that's really perceptive. I think it's very perceptive that people are very thirsty on Dune all the time.
Yeah, I was in Palm Springs, just recently, and it was over 120 degrees, and people tell me, like, oh, you're from Miami where the humidity is so high. You know, this is a dry heat. Oh, no, you're going to be roasting on fire, okay? I've never been so hot in my life, okay? So if this guy is going out to some planet where there's not only it's real hot and there's no water and just no AC, I don't know. I just assume there's not any AC. But, yeah, this doesn't sound good to me. Sounds like he should stay where he's at.
Yeah.
Well, the Emperor has ordered it, so who's that? I don't know yet, but we'll find out.
Good, good. So what did Gurney and Paul get into?
They were fighting. And so I think Gurney was his like weapons master, and he's like this, I don't know if he's a jovial guy, but he's Paul's friend, and they have a rapport with each other. And usually, I guess, you know, he's been training him, but Gurney today or in chapter four was like taking it really seriously because Paul's just like, I'm not in the mood or something. And he was really testing him, because when a battle comes up, you can't just, you have to give it your best. You can't, there's no room, no margin of error.
So you mentioned Thufir Hawat as well. It's the master of assassins.
Thufir, yes.
Just to go a little earlier, what do you make of Thufir Hawat's feelings about the Lady Jessica?
I thought he liked Lady Jessica. I can't remember. It's been a minute, but I remember they were like promising Lady Jessica to him or something. So I think everybody likes Lady Jessica. It seems like she is the one. Maybe the old witch was mad at her because she didn't have a girl. She had a boy. But even so, she had this special boy. So maybe that makes up for not having a girl. I don't know. There is some tension, by the way, that I picked up on between Thufir and the old witch, the Reverend Mother. Paul lied, sort of, or maybe not lied. Maybe he just withheld information from Thufir. He did not tell him about the little like hand in the bag situation with the pain. Remember that little test in this chapter one. He didn't tell Thufir about that. So yeah, because he's a mentat. He ain't a human. Okay, so.
I just to clarify, both he and Piter are mentats, right? And Piter is the one, I think, from the previous chapter that you were talking about, who was promised Lady Jessica.
Okay.
But you're right. They're both mentats. And I think that I just wanted to clarify. So we got Piter in the previous chapter.
Who wants her? Okay.
Right. And then Thufir in this chapter, who I think you're totally right. He's very suspicious of the Reverend Mother.
Yeah. He called her a witch spy.
So do you remember any details about, like, the fight between Paul and Gurney? Like, kind of what it was like and stuff? And
it was in a classroom, kind of his training center. Caught my attention that somebody always has to go ahead and, like, clear the room, you know? Like, if president is going to a place, like, the Secret Service would come and clear it and make sure that there's no dangers lurking. There's some sort of like secret codes that they put that was interesting, like to indicate that it had been cleared. And the fight, it started off kind of, I think, silly, but then Paul realized, wait a minute, he's super serious. This gets into a part where I like don't care for, which was like maybe the sci-fi element of it, where there's like some sort of like activated shield or something, and like weird fighting instruments, like these weapons that I'm like, I don't know, just call it a sword or whatever, but now they have kindles or something, I don't know, I'm not familiar, maybe that is a thing, I don't know. But I did look in the glossary, and there it was. Thank you, Marlon. But yeah, so the fight was, it was good. Paul was growing as a fighter. And at some point he still makes mistakes. I remember this part where, you know, the sword was near his groin, shall we say, and that could be bad. It's a real fight that would not end well.
There's a little bit of an intro reading where it talks about these guys being Paul's only companions.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It's sort of sad that his only companions, he's 14-ish. I forget if they told us how old he is, but I'm guessing he's around 14 or 15. He's young, but, you know, about to take on some real true responsibility. Ruler. And so these are his friends. It sounds like he hasn't had the luxury of playmates. like childhood friends, and you know, I don't know how many video games he gets to play, if he's ever seen Grand Theft Auto. It doesn't sound like it. Probably hasn't watched E.T. or, you know, done normal kid stuff. He just hung out with adults. And the whole intent was to, like, you know, prepare him as the Duke's son and her. But what it just sounds like they're preparing him in this, like, very intense way to start battle tomorrow. In the way that, like, let's say, you know, we think about the royals in the UK, it's like they're not ready to battle like tomorrow at 14 or 15 years old. You know? What?
That's like a really good point. It's a really good point. Hey, Marlon, you want to take that one?
You know, I'm not sure that I have a whole lot else. Like, I kind of like, I mean, is there anything else that you have questions for us on, or did you have something you wanted to bounce off of the Royals question with?
Yeah, well, that I was wondering, I mean, so I think your question about this, Marianne, is why do they seem to be preparing Paul so intensely for combat now? My take is that Paul is always, this is just, I mean, this is his whole life, is training. I think they're training with rapiers in this scene, which are like, you know, the like fencing swords, really like long and skinny. But I think they just assume he's going to be the Duke one day because he's the only son of the Duke. And that's how the society works.
I think this is a much more conflict-ridden political environment than we live in now in terms of just direct attacks, and in terms of like subterfuge and kind of like assassination and stuff. So I think you always have to be prepared for the worst. And you know, we got a glimpse of their enemies, the Harkonnens, in a previous chapter, and they seem to be pretty like nasty. So I'm sure their communication isn't very friendly.
Did you like the song in this chapter?
The song was excellent. Yes. At the beginning of the chapter, they literally, it says, you will sing some of Gurney's songs as you read along in this book. And then there was one. So that's kind of nice. The song itself was not the greatest, but, I liked it. I like that, you know, everybody thinks about the same things, whether you're on Dune or on Earth.
Like what?
The ladies, you know, everyone's got their mind on the ladies. Grandma used to say, you know, everything leads to one thing and one thing only.
What did she mean? That's good. That sounds like something Gurney would say. Where do you think the book is going from this point?
I think it set us up for like, life was good over here on Caladan. And now they're off to Arrakis, the arid land of Dune, where life is going to be terrible. And there's going to be all sorts of hardship. You're going to be so thirsty. The storms are going to be so bad. And yeah, it's just going to be treacherous. That's what I think. I mean, obviously, they've introduced so many characters that I think there's going to be a lot of battles. The fact that they're even preparing him in this physical combat kind of training, I think that's something to look forward to. The fact that you have this, like, Master of Assassins, let me say, favorite title ever. And you have that, and then the fact that they're training is good. You know, it's promising. It's not just going to be this, like, philosophical book about this or that. It sounds like they're actually going to have fights, and people are gonna live and die, and people are gonna suffer for better or worse, right? Makes the reading interesting.
So this is probably my last question, but like, do you have I'm not sure how much they get into the still suit operation, but do you have any like speculation as to how a still suit would help like to conserve the body's moisture, both like based on what they described and what you might think?
Oh boy, I don't know how that would work. I was thinking of like garbage bags. So I was thinking like just collect all the sweat. and then recycle it somehow. Somehow, like a, you know, a desalination plant or something.
Sure, like God, like, you know, like the suits that people wear to gyms.
I just think like about like Missy bags. Elliott, you know? Yeah.
There we go.
Like a Missy Elliott suit.
Marianne, I'm really excited to visit Palm Springs with you in the next chapter.
Awesome. That is what's next.
All right.
Okay. So now for a segment we like to call Kol Wahad versus Gom Jabbar. So according to the appendix, Kol Wahad means I am profoundly stirred.
And the Gom Jabbar, of course, means the high-handed enemy. And is basically a poison tip needle that'll kill you real quick. So what is your Kol Wahad moment from this chapter?
So my Kol Wahad related to the stuff we were talking about earlier. I really like that the Reverend Mother kind of goes into this weird fugue, maybe, where she starts describing Dune almost as if she's like reading from some text or reciting a prayer or song. And because I don't really know, like, or again, like you said, or maybe she's having some sort of vision of the future, some prescience. But she says, "You'll learn about the funeral plains," she said, "about the wilderness that is empty, the wasteland where nothing lives except the spice and the sandworms. You stain your eye pits to reduce the sun glare. Shelter will mean a hollow out of the wind and hidden from view. You'll ride upon your own 2 feet without thopter or ground car or mount." And Paul had been caught more by her tone, sing-song and wavering, than by her words. So I really like that she enters that weird moment. And similarly, there's another moment later in here where Paul is describing something the Reverend Mother says. And I believe it says that he kind of like adopts her tone in saying it. So I just like these kind of like strange moments of like recitation or recall between the Reverend Mother and Paul.
Kol Wahad.
Kol Wahad.
So my Kol Wahad moment is at the very end. Gurney has this little moment. For some reason, he recalled his younger sister, her elfin face so clear in his mind. But she was dead now, in a pleasure house for Harkonnen troops. She had loved pansies. Or was it daisies? He couldn't remember. It bothered him that he couldn't remember. And that's it. Just like a little sad moment.
Right. The book is so full of melodrama and big moments and huge success and huge loss that it's interesting and personal in a way the book often doesn't get. Because the book will have some moment of like intense introspection that's very complicated, but this is very simple.
Yeah, and it's a nice moment of showing without telling. It doesn't say he was very sad. It just says he couldn't remember and it bothered him that he couldn't remember. And I kind of even like that it's maudlin enough to use pansies and daisies and not the fire fruit of the planet, sure. You know, Ginjas or whatever. It's daisies and pansies. We all know daisies and pansies. So that's my Kol Wahad moment. And my Gom Jabbar moment is something we sort of talked about, but I actually want to read it. This is in the flashback. The Reverend Mother says, she held up 4 big knuckled fingers. And then she's saying, "A world is supported by 4 things. The learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, and the valor of the brave. But all these are as nothing," she closed her fingers into a fist, "without a ruler who knows the art of ruling. Make that the science of your tradition." It's kind of just like word salad.
It's awful.
It's like none of those things. It's like, that's not particularly interesting.
It's like you need people to be smart and good at things and like,
yeah,
and valorous. And it's like, of course. You know?
I mean, I'd like to read this as a characterization of the Reverend Mother, that she's so old and she's been teaching for so long that she's sort of another kind of older person who's lost their touch. But I think I just kind of think it's like politics 101 in a book that is so often has a more interesting political nuance to it. So that's my Gom Jabbar moment. What about your Gom Jabbar moment?
My Gom Jabbar is something that came up earlier. It's the whole point about the mystery of life. It reads, Paul shrugged. Then she said a good ruler has to learn this world's language, that it's different for every world, and I thought she meant they didn't speak Gaelic on Arrakis. But she said that wasn't it at all. She said she meant the language of the rocks and growing things, the language you don't hear with your ears. And I said, that's what Dr. Yui calls the mystery of life. Anyway, I just think that, like, you get so much with, like, kinds and, like, complicated ecology and all that stuff. This just seems so, like, basic. That, yeah, I don't know.
It's like a Schoolhouse Rock song. And that's the mystery of life.
Yeah. I don't love it.
I love that Gurney drags him by saying, it was decided in council, you being such a poor fighter, we'd best teach you in the music trade so you won't waste your life.
There's so much good language and there's a lot of great banter. But, like, I appreciated the banter reading it slowly this time more. Like, I appreciated this chapter so much more this time than I did the first time. I just wish the Reverend Mother stuff wasn't in there. It's got all this great writing, but just really basic content in some spots.
I feel like the Reverend Mother stuff in this chapter was stuff he wanted to put in the earlier chapters, and then he had it in his notes, and he was like, let me just cram it in as a little flashback. Like, I think every once in a while, I feel like Frank Herbert writes something that he thinks is cool.
But I think the only like, bit of substance in all the Reverend Mother stuff is her saying, like, your father had a lot to learn, Paul being like, no, he's a really good leader, and she's like, he's going to lose everything he has, you know, Caliban, Dune, everything. And I think I like that, and I like her kind of waxing about Dune in that weird, like, moment of reverie she had. But everything else, I think, is just kind of wasted.
Yeah, I mean, I like her final thing where she says she likes that he says the Mentat, the little, like, first law of Mentats about a process being a thing. I mean, that's not even coming from her.
Sure.
She just likes the quote. Alright, so now it's time for the Dune Film Club, where we watch some selected moments from both the 1984 David Lynch adaptation
and the 2000 Sci-Fi Channel adaptation.
And then we're going to talk about them. So, based on this chapter, what are you hoping to see in these clips?
Like the last few chapters, I kind of want to see the relationships and the camaraderie. I like the way Gurney and Thufir are guardians, but also friends and instructors. I'm curious to see how the Gurney Paul fight is handled in each of the films.
I remember being very interested when I was first read this and how the shield gets portrayed. So I want to see a little bit of that. I want to see that camaraderie coming through, that these are Paul's friends as well as his instructors, and assassin masters.
Yep. All right, let's do it.
Let's roll the film. Let's do it.
I'm not in the mood.
Not in the mood. Mood's a thing for cattle and love play, not fighting.
I'm sorry, Gurney.
Not sorry enough.
All right. David Lynch Dune.
David Lynch Dune. A little bit of a intro from Princess Irulan.
Yep.
And then
Storm.
A sweet glow globe.
Yeah, we've got some beachside cliffs, some rather aggressive surf, some stormy skies. We've got a castle standing starkly on its own with sort of like no development or anything around it, which is...
It's so funny.
It's so weird. You see similar things when Arrakis... when you see, like, I believe their palace in Arrakeen and the Emperor's kind of weird tent is just sort of... They just stand out on their own.
Yeah, it was like someone was like, it's a castle, and he was like, oh, like Dracula, like just a castle by itself, and everybody's like, well, I mean, maybe there's a city.
Right. Nothing around it, but that you can see. There's a wall going off to the side, so maybe the town is inside the wall. Anyway.
Sure.
So yeah, nice wooden room, glow globes. We get...
All right. Well, Paul's like on his iPad, which I love. Paul's doing some remote learning, very topical.
Yeah, I love the film books. They look super...
A lot of kids are doing that these days.
They look super thick and heavy, and they have, like, these four buttons or knobs. You never see how he's, like, navigating any of the, like, interface, because it's zoomed in really close, our view of it. So you just hear him, like, clickety-clacking around.
Is this a thing... Okay, I'm racking my brain. in your version, are the planets oblong, like football?
Oh, absolutely. They've always been that way. So the planets, the film book, the people that created the content for the film book decided to stylize the planets. Because nothing else is oblong. You hear them clickety-clacking around, but everything is represented, you know, in a normal sort of, like, ratio, except the planets, which are, like, stretched horizontally. And the planets are so stylized. It's crazy.
I would love to know if that was a mistake, that they made them the wrong, you know, they made the actual graphic. Because you never see a graphic in context, right? This is always a thing we talk about in production. We're always like, are we going to see the graphic on the iPad? Or are we going to see the iPad and then cut into the graphic? Mm-hmm. Because I wonder if they made the graphics and they made them and they just weren't wide enough for the screen, and so they just had to optically stretch them. And so, yeah, they're oblong, like you said. It's like there's an implication that you're moving through sort of space at some point, as if it's showing things almost like a Google map of space. But then when it goes to the planet, it's almost like an icon, and it's oblong.
Yeah, I mean, and the planets are very stylized besides that. You see some of these planets. Like, you see Giedi Prime at the very beginning of the movie, after the Irulan introduction, when they're like a secret report within the guild. They show you three planets on the screen, and I don't think they're oblong at that point. I think they're round.
I don't think so either.
So you see the same Giedi Prime here oblong, but the planets are really stylized. Like, Benny Tylax has, like, so many fucking moons around it that could, like, never exist, really. Because I was
they look like they're literally 45 feet above, like,
oh my god, it's like they would just be banging into each other constantly and stuff. So,
and they're all different color, each one. Yeah, it's like crazy. It's like pool balls on a table.
I know, it's like a bag of candy or marbles. Yeah. Or something. And so I do love the oblong planets. I do love the way the camera zooms in really close to the film book, so that sometimes you're, like, looking at, like, what looks like a quarter of the screen versus the whole screen, because there's like a grid of boxes that presumably is part of the, like, navigation and selection interface. So I like that it kind of suggests that Paul can kind of navigate around there and select different items on the screen. It's really weird from, like, a librarian's perspective that this is some sort of reference material that is, like, so kind of short. In terms of content, like, it's like database is like, there's like nothing there. If you go to Arrakis and you hit weather and it says sea storms, no precipitation, it's like, right. Weather is a primary feature of Arrakis. And the fact that when he, like, queries weather there, there's no information. There's just the entry for storms, and also and also no rain. And that,
right, as if,
and that's
as
it.
If temperature
that's
it. Is not an issue.
Like, right. in 1984, you could open up the World Book Encyclopedia and get better weather on, like, a random country you would look up, I'm sure.
On, like, the Gobi Desert.
Yeah, yeah. Right, a specific biome, you could get a much more interesting, a much more thorough weather thing. Good.
I also love that when he searches Caladan, the first thing he gets is this picture of the ring.
Right.
The ducal signet ring, as if that's the most important thing about this entire planet,
like,
and people.
It's crazy. Like, does it autoplay that? Or did he select it? Because if he selected it, that's even sillier.
That he would select, like, oh, let's look at Dad's ring.
Yeah, right. Oh, the ring. Yeah, the focus on the ring is really very, very funny, because it's like the House Atreides, and it's a picture of the ring, not the symbol on the ring, not even the ring, not even sort of a shot straight down or a photo of the
ring. Right, it gives you no information about the ring, except that it is a ring.
Right, it's like, where did they even get this photo? Where did they get this image of the ring with no finger in it by itself? It's what he submitted it to the whatever. The,
right. Like, so you're telling me that this, like, database, this encyclopedia, has a picture of the ducal signet ring when you click on Caladan, but when you click on Arrakis, it doesn't have, like, a full entry on the weather. You know?
Yeah. Talk about the conspiracy about Arrakis's weather satellites and stuff. Yeah, like you said, the shiny wooden desk, all the stuff in the room, all the good, like, Caladan wood is here, and then Paul's adult friends all come in the room all together, in like a little, like a clique in high school.
Yeah, no, they definitely come in in a bad girls type like formation. There are Atreides troops kind of hanging out, sort of like I don't know, like British kind of beefeater castle guards, just like standing around doing nothing. And they have these rifles that are really goofy looking. They kind of have these ends that look like plungers or something. I'm not sure. Sort of like a, yeah. What are those called? Those shotguns with the plunger kind of ends. A blunderbuss. Like a blunderbuss, but like yep. a weird kind of like accordion on the end of it. It's very strange.
I think when I first saw this, it was either on TV or... And I feel like it was too small. I didn't even realize that the guys are just sort of standing there for the whole conversation. It's very funny. There are probably 10 soldiers up on this sort of balcony and in the background. It's really an interesting moment to think that Paul is by himself in the room studying, and all these dudes are just standing
watching him clickety-clack on the film books. Yeah.
It's like just watching him play on his iPad. It's so funny.
So Thufir has he's sporting a nice fur collar. Yui's costume is like amazing.
Like possible little syringes that he could pop off and stuff like that, all on his sort of right the left breast of his outfit. Very good. And he's got his little diamond, of course.
Yeah, he's got this mustache, this little short kind of with a split in the middle mustache. So they come in, you know, Paul asks if they're here to test him. Yes. And it kind of immediately shifts into the fight between Paul and Gurney. And Gurney is a lot less kind of... he's a lot less friendly, a lot less familial, at least at the beginning of the scene. It never reaches any of the kind of familiarity or, like, jocular tone of the book.
Yeah, even... when he comes in with his balisette, which we'll say is based on the design of the Chapman stick, which I might toss in a little Chapman stick music here. There's none of that chummy camaraderie initially with Gurney. They immediately say they're going to have practice, and then they turn on their shields, and I love the shield effect.
I love the shield effect, too. I mean, it's animation inserted into the frame, and it originates at a circular belt buckle that's got a button on it, and it kind of... It's like these polygons emerge from either side of the belt buckle and form a... sort of like rectangular, shimmering with light.
Like an oily lens.
Yeah.
It's like everything, you see through them, but it's sort of just distorted, like you're looking through a lens that's been smeared with Vaseline or something.
Right, to the extent that sometimes like the figures, they're extending outside of the lens. You don't see it, but it like cuts them off, essentially. I love the shields. The shields look like the product of kind of their stunted technology, right? It looks like it's like retrofuturism, like at its best, I think.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's very blocky. I used to think that they looked like they were inside of Jello, but it's I don't think I've ever seen anything like it otherwise. The way that the polygons sort of move with them, even they jab their knives out. And it's notable here that they don't use rapiers. They're using just daggers in this scene. So there's no actual sword play. It's all just a knife fight, which the movie kind of just makes all the fighting knife fights, all the combat.
Yeah.
And they look great. They're great. And when they push the button again at the end, the little red button, it sucks back in into the shield on their side. It's such a nice effect.
Yeah, and it definitely adds to the kind of visceral, like, immediate nature of the fight, that the light's all, like, refracted, that you've got all of these electrical discharges happening, each with each blow and stuff. Like, you feel kind of as confused as, like, someone who's engaged in the fight a little bit. Right now, I feel like... If that was to be represented, the shield would be very clear, and the fight choreography would be very readable and stuff. And it's not super readable here because the shields are so confusing. And I love that.
It looks like it's like smashing two Lego men against one another. Sort of, it's just this sort of blocky thing smashing into one another, but it's still kinetic.
What's wrong with Gurney? You're not faking this.
Now, guard yourself from truth.
You hear the hum, and it really, I always feel like that hum reminds me of the thing in the book where they talk about the ozone smell that starts building up as the thing. It's definitely got a little of that cool early lightsaber hum and that discharge sound.
Is this what you seek?
God, the slow blade penetrates the shield, but,
It's great. It's a real classic moment from the movie.
We'd have joined each other in death. Did it seem finally to get the mood?
And then Paul has this really, like, dorky... I think it's so dorky, where he's kind of like, I think there's some conspiracy, and I think the Emperor has something to do with it. And everyone's like, you're going to be quite the Duke. It's really out of character for the Thufir that we sort of later, I mean, I don't know. I think it's like a little dorky that they're also like, wow, Paul, very nice.
It's dorky because he has this kind of like wry kind of like expression when he's like delivering these ideas that aren't particularly earth-shattering. But I do excuse his kind of conspiratorial like speculation, because it allows Thufir to like kind of congratulate him and have a moment where he's like patting him on the shoulders and being really like sweet to him.
It's one of my favorite moments in the movie. It's really indelible. Anyway, it's really in my brain. Thufir kind of, he doesn't say anything.
Yeah, he makes a sound.
He's like growls.
Yeah,
he growls. It's real. It's almost like a purr. He just goes like grrr, and he just thumps. Like three thumps on Paul's
great.
Shoulder.
It's so sweet. It's so intimate. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the movie does a fairly good job of those realizations that these are Paul's friends, you know, and they're chummy with him, and they look upon him as like, you know, hey, kiddo, it's kind of got that feeling.
Yeah, it communicates a lot with a little, because it's a relatively short scene. There's not much exposition. There's none of that, you know, kind of joking and banter and stuff. But the body language, I think, goes pretty far.
This next moment is the introduction of something that I think is maybe one of the most controversial things that the David Lynch movie does, because it's an introduction of something entirely... whole cloth, effectively, into the Dune universe, and it's the weirding mod.
Right, and not only is it a whole cloth invention, it's a whole cloth invention that is kind of co-opting an idea of the books, right, by using the term weirding.
Right. In the books, I don't think we've come across weirding just yet, but... It's a complicated idea in the book. It obviously has a connection to, like, the weird sisters from Macbeth, the idea of weird as sort of magic or some kind of a not understood element. And David Lynch literally makes it into a sort of a voice box.
Right. He basically...
That connects to a gun?
Yeah, he basically makes it into a gun because... I think a lot of the combat as represented in the books is part of this like weirding discipline, which is this sort of mind-body unity, you know, incredibly quick movement, incredibly astute perception of your surroundings. These ideas that would be hard to film in 1984. And so they basically just created a gun. And the only thing I really like about this is that the weirding module around the neck, which is supposed to pick up some sort of like vibration, some sort of vocalization, and then kind of transmit it to the gun unit and amplify it and direct it. I'd like that both the units just look like shit. Like the gun part looks like a watering can or like an oil can from Wizard of Oz. I don't know why I think of those two things.
It's such a weird... It's in a movie where so much feels very bespoke and very designed and of a piece, it's weird. It looks... They look like half-done props. Like, someone was like, let's just bring in these training props, sort of. And then that's what they ended up running with. I mean, I think I like... I appreciate the difficulty in trying to figure out how to make the voice... The Bene Gesserit voice, the idea that Paul's mother Jessica's Bene Gesserit training is somehow martial in nature, and Paul can kind of turn it into a martial art. And also trying to suggest, because it also becomes a sort of reason that the Atreides are considered a threat to the Emperor because they have this technology. But it's just, it kind of feels like an attempt at like a toy. Like someone said, we can't just have them have knives. That's not interesting. We need something more. And
I just think it's strange that if like there was some marketing interest in this change to the story, that it would look so ugly. Like, what kid would want to run around with that shit? You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of in video game development when you have an early prototype of, like, a asset and you haven't textured it and stuff, and you just kind of, like, have a, like you said, a placeholder. It looks like something that they didn't put all the pieces on. So.
Yeah, I mean, earlier in the scene, the table that Paul is sitting at has carved hawks as the family crest on the legs of the table, and then they're like, let's put on these weirding modules, and they just look like doorbells strapped to their throat, you know?
Yeah, look, the details everywhere, like the walls of Paul's room, there are like characters like carved into the walls and symbols and things that are just, they're just embellishment, and they're beautiful, and you're like, wow. I have to believe that David Lynch was like, I want to in some ways represent technology or weaponry in this really kind of like brutal kind of, I don't know, rough hewn way. Cause you see similar things with the Thopters, you know, you have these things that are probably, he's like, I don't really know how this would look. So I'm just going to make it look like, I don't know, this clunky cobbled together thing.
You're right. There is a similarity in the Thopter design, that real, that like just this sort of brass box that does remind me of the weirding modules. So yeah, I mean, maybe it's just, I don't know, it's the Atreides technology is just all this sort of brass box looking stuff. And so basically Paul has this fight with a...
Activate a fighter!
I don't know, I mean, how to describe it. This thing that pops out of the ceiling and has little... I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, whatever. It's a training thing that shoots out.
It's a robot, but it's like one of those, like, kung... It's like one of those, I don't want to say the wrong word here, but martial arts, like wooden with the like sticks that just, like, block and stuff.
That's right.
Except it's like active, and it's got all of these unnecessarily like weird and complicated little whirligigs with blades and stuff that like it'll have like this thing that like telescopes out and like a spinning blade and stuff, or like a sword will like come out of a side, or a dart will shoot, and this is shit that could like really fuck up Paul, and I don't know if there's some like measure to ensure his safety, but it looks like it would really hurt him.
Well, Paul's like on, he changes, he puts on this sort of like little like padded suit. But it's funny because he's also shooting. He's shooting things normally, right?
No, it's the exact same thing as the rest of
precise control.
I know, it's crazy. It's like a training dummy that you're talking about. You aren't literally destroying the dummy every time. And the scene, he's shooting off these intricate spinning blade pieces, and they're melting. One of them, they pop, and then one of them like melts, and they get really impressed that he sort of sets it on fire.
No, I had the same thought. I'm like, is this like, are these like little parts they just replace every time? They have a pack of these spears and like blades that they just like snap back in, because normally, like, in a video game or in some sort of like science fiction where there's some kind of automated system, like training system, right? The threat or weapon components of the system are usually separate from the target and vulnerable components. So you don't normally like shoot the like sword. You don't normally shoot the like bullet out of the gun, you know. You don't normally shoot the gun. I mean, sometimes you shoot the gun, but like in this case, like, it has no weak points. He's just literally like, it's like shooting the claws off of a monster. It's really weird.
You know what it reminds me of? It clicked in my head. In Gremlins, the dad has this device that's supposed to do everything for in the morning, a big Swiss Army knife that all like a toothbrush pops out and then it squirts. It's supposed to squirt toothpaste on it. Do you remember this scene?
Vaguely.
His dad makes all. It's just. It's like it reminds me of something that's in an 80s movie. Someone being like, "It slices. It dices. It julienne fries." Like the idea of this gadget that just has all this kind of junk in it, and Paul is just shooting off all the parts that seem to be what make it the most, you know, useful thing in the room.
Right. Like, he's attacking it in a way... Like, he's not attacking it in a way that you try to destroy something, right? It's like if you're fighting a giant, like, automated Swiss Army knife, you know? And blades and stuff. And you're like, well, I guess it's not useful now, but it's still here.
Right, right. All right, so should we... And that's basically the end of the scene. I mean, he has the fight. They're very impressed. They're, like, such control. I do like that Thufir just sort of sits back nodding and smiling. It's nice.
Yeah.
And then yeah.
It's fun. The music's good and weird during that scene, too. I think it's good. The only time you hear that particular bit of music. It's kind of these metallic percussion things. It reminds me a little bit of portions of the Predator soundtrack.
All right, shall we move on to sci-fi?
Let's do it.
You forgot your first principle, Gurney. Not likely. Look down, lad. Perhaps you'd like to sing soprano next time I play. Guess I'm just not in the mood today. Not in the mood? Mood is a thing for cattle and women, young pup. Mood is not for fighting. Even with the weird and ways your mother teaches you.
It's that old Bene Gesserit witch. Something she said. Or did.
All right, we're back. And we've watched the Sci-Fi Channel Dune, but before we get into that, I just wanted to mention one other moment from the David Lynch version. Poor Sci-Fi Dune. It can't even get our full attention in its own segment. Anyway,
I know.
There's a great moment in the shield fight where Patrick Stewart kind of does, like, I guess a dive to, like, get a better position or to avoid a blow. And it's filmed such that, like, the camera's, like, in front and he's, like, Superman diving, like, toward the camera and his shield. And it's just...
I know. Right, keep in mind, it's as if he's got a cardboard box, a translucent cardboard box around him as he's doing this dive over the camera.
Right.
It's not
every day you get to see Patrick Stewart in a, like, gelatinous Earl Grey tea cube, like, Supermaning toward the camera. Just saying.
Well, and it's... I mean, I think let's talk about the sci-fi version. I mean... We want to do pros and cons. We keep saying we're trying to say positive things and negative things about both of them, but it's so notable. I mean, okay, I get it. It's budget. They don't represent the shields whatsoever. This scene just starts with the fight already going. You're back in boring looking Caladan. It's just like a big metal box with nothing interesting in the training room, and they're wearing kind of just white and black. The Atreides are so boring. Looking in this,
I think Paul's outfit always reads kind of like Luke Skywalker on Hoth. What's it called? Tatooine.
Yeah, the, like, just sort of baggy shirt.
Sure.
So they have this fight. I think that there is some, for some reason, a perception of the sci-fi version that the sci-fi version is somehow more faithful to the book, but. This watch, it's. I mean, this scene, there's no camaraderie whatsoever with Paul and Gurney or Paul and Thufir here.
I mean,
all.
I think the general consensus is the sci-fi version is more like beat by beat, like content-wise, like hitting all of the things that happen, not necessarily the characterization.
It maybe adds fewer things. There's no weirding modules. This is just a fight. Notably, it's a knife fight. Not a rapier fight. That was surprising to me. I almost expected to see this as a rapier fight, because why not just make it a rapier fight? That's what the book says it is. They're fighting. It's kind of, they have two knives, which is sort of cool, but they're also holding them upside down. Gurney almost has no dialogue, which is surprising, because Gurney is sort of a character who's supposed to talk all the time. And Paul is just... He's still such a brat. He's such a, and he's old. He's too old to be a brat. He's just a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, he is kind of dominating the whole fight. The same kind of, like, revelation happens at the end where Gurney was going to, like, cut his dick off. But
they make it clear. They make it clear that Gurney's definitely pointing it at his groin.
They do. Patrick Stewart's, like, too classy to mention that, like, his knife is on, like, Paul's dick. But this guy is, like...
Paul's special,
like,
purpose.
He's, like, you know, right, special purpose, his hog.
No, not AKA, his special purpose. His, AKA, wait, his, what is it? It's not special purpose.
Dreadful destiny. I can't remember what it is now. Anyway, we'll maybe edit that, maybe not. But yeah, this guy didn't give a shit about mentioning to the future Duke that his dick's about to get cut off.
He's like, you might want to, you're gonna be singing soprano after this.
I mean, maybe he deserves it though, because Paul really does kind of dominate the fight. It doesn't feel like Gurney's teaching him. It's just a single stage fight, which it was single stage in David Lynch as well, but it's single stage, and then Paul kind of says he's not in the mood and storms out.
I mean, this is me being pedantic, but he drops his shield belt, which is always a thing in the book, that the nobles are constantly wearing shield belts. They're not things you strap on for a fight. You have it on all the time because there's always a threat. Do they even bring up the idea that maybe this is a real... There's like that Gurney's maybe betraying? He says it really quick, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean... I don't hate this scene, but it's really boring. I don't hate this the way I hated the last three. There was, in every scene we've watched previously of this version, there's been something I've hated. There's nothing I hated here. It's just boring. And same thing with the follow-up scene. There's a conversation he has with Thufir that's sort of about the climate and about the potential trap.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's an interesting addition here with this conversation about Thufir distrusting Bene Gesserit, but it doesn't really go anywhere.
And Mentats, and I think maybe Mentats in general distrust
that seems
Bene
to be
Gesserit.
The suggestion that Mentats in general distrust Bene Gesserit. Paul,
which is cool. It's illustrating like a subtext of the book.
Yes,
you know?
The idea that and the idea that Paul is a Mentat and a Bene Gesserit, which I feel like the film hasn't. Not that either film really gets into it, but that is a theme in the book, and so it's nice to have those things bouncing around. Paul, as usual, sitting like such a little dick in the chair. He like sits like all sideways in the chair. It doesn't even look like a chair that would be comfortable to sit that way. It's just like he's sitting there because he's playing as this entitled teen. Not even a teen.
Well, Thufir's also kind of sitting in a douchey way. Well, so far in this movie, in douchey
ways. In the previous
ways.
Scene, Thufir's sort of leaning... Full body lean on like a balcony, like a kid watching a basketball game at a high school. He's sort of leaning on this thing from above, and there's nothing really visible about the Mentat that you see. He just kind of wears a green robe and has kind of the same haircut as Gurney.
Yeah, it's super boring. I don't have anything else to say about this.
I know it's tough. It's tough. The sci-fi version. I'm trying to find things. Okay, here's my pro. Like I said, they fight with two knives, and it looks like a pretty legit fight.
Yeah, Gurney does a pose with the two knives. It's really, like, funny.
Yeah, he flips them from above to upside down, maybe at some point or something. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
I shouldn't call it a pose. It just looks like a pose. Anyway.
Production design-wise, we're back in just everything is silver. And then they actually, we watched a little bit of the scene that happens on, I suppose it's supposed to be the Atreides ship, inside the Highliner, but it just looks boring. It just looks like the same as the inside of their castle, which is just steel gray, nothing.
Yeah, I have nothing else to say about this.
All right, let's wrap it up.
All right.
So, time for some final thoughts on this chapter.
It's a good chapter, like I said. I think it stands out in its little bits of elegant writing, even though it kind of goes broad with some of the... world building.
Yeah, it's got a bit of a challenge. It's to introduce these characters and to introduce this kind of weird state that Paul is, that he's this 15-year-old kid who only has adults as friends. And I think the book does a good job with it. The movies, obviously, there's a bit of a challenge. You have to introduce a bunch of characters who are fairly complex and fairly different really quick. David Lynch sort of rolls them all out almost awkwardly, but it works, sort of. And then the sci-fi version just...
It's tough.
Kind of doesn't do any introduction to these characters, and you're just supposed to sort of get it from them.
Yeah, it's also It's really difficult to compare the two, because when you see Dean Stockwell and Patrick Stewart and Freddie Jones and Kyle MacLachlan, you're like, these are actors that I all have like warm feelings up for from other work that they've done and associations I have with them, you know?
Yeah. I just wish that it's right now, I'm just wishing the sci-fi version, it's almost like I'd rather it do almost a Watchmen-esque, very... like the Watchmen.
Sure, like a slavish adaptation.
If it's not going to give us something pretty to look at or compelling, like actors and stuff like that, sure.
Yeah. And it's kind of doing neither so far. It sort of borrows a few things from David Lynch, and those are often the interesting things, and then the other stuff just anyway. So those are our final thoughts. I thank you for listening. I'm on Twitter at Zerobot, that's ZEROBOT.
And I'm on Twitter at, I'm not really sure yet, I'm still trying to figure that out.
The podcast is on Twitter at Dune Buddies Pod, and that's DuneBuddiesPod, Pod, P-O-D, Dune Buddies Pod, all one word. And we've also got an 11-episode podcast out there called Text Adventure Purgatory that we might get back to at some point. But it's worth having a listen to if you like text adventures and video games and that sort of thing.
Please tune into our next episode of Dune Buddies, in which the notorious Dr. Yui, for all of his later betrayals, will give Paul the coolest little, like, gift ever. So, all is forgiven, maybe.
Dr. Yui, remember the toot.
All right, well, I'm going to stop recording because this thing's fucking long.
Change the world and they certainly won't get